WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Today is Election Day, and with me is Mark Allen Stamaty, the creator of one of America's blandest elected leaders, Bob Farhad. Congressman Bob Farhad is the protagonist of Stamaty's weekly cartoon strip, Washington, which was first commissioned by the Washington Post and appears weekly in the Village Voice, and is now featured Mondays on the Philadelphia Inquirer's op-ed page. Followers of Washington know that Bob Farhad's real ambition is to one day host a TV quiz show. It took the know-how of a team of skilled charismaticians and perceptual engineers to groom Farhad for the congressional elections. Now as a congressman, he's a spokesman for the tycoon sector. Farhad's thick clump of blow-dried, sprayed hair, which overhangs his forehead, has enabled him to become the leader of the JFK look-alike conservative caucus. Mark Allen Stamaty has been doing Washington since 1981, November. A collection of Washington strips has just been published by Congdon and Weed, and if you have only been reading Washington since the Inquirer picked it up a couple of months ago, you'll be clued into the whole history of Bob Farhad by reading the book. Stamaty's first strip, McDoodle Street, based on his observations of McDougal Street in New York's Greenwich Village, was published in the Village Voice from 1978 to 79. Stamaty is also the author and illustrator of several children's books, including Who Needs Donuts and Where's My Hippopotamus. And Mark, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a great pleasure to have you here.
Thank you. A pleasure to be here.
Maybe you can fill us in on the background of Bob Farhad's entrance into politics for our listeners who just started reading Washington and the Inquirer.
Okay, I'll try to do this now. I don't know yet if Gerard B. Oxbogle has appeared in the Inquirer, but he is the president of the Glaminoid Corporation, and he was the first character to appear in the strip. I'll attempt to read this, and I'll see how it goes. It's March 3rd, 1977. This is the very first strip. 2:14 a.m. Gerard Oxbogle is can't sleep. Not again, he says. His wife says, "Your nerves, Jerry?" "Yes, damn it. I haven't had a good night's sleep since they blocked that merger." Wearily, Gerard V. Oxbogle, president of the Glaminoid Corporation, made his way downstairs for a glass of warm milk. "And those damn regulations. I thought this was a free country. We should send all those liberals to Russia. We've got to get some sensible politicians who can listen to reason. Turn this country around. Get government off our backs." He turned on the television. "What I need is a protege, a mind I can mold." Okay, now from the television, an announcer comes on who says, "That's right, folks. You get 12 glow-in-the-dark solid plastic coat hangers in 6 assorted colors, yours for only $39.95. Just send your check and a stamped self-addressed corrugated box to Hanglow Enterprises, etc." So Gerard Oxbogle finds himself writing down the address to this to send away for these coat hangers, and suddenly he catches himself. "Hey, why am I writing this? I've no use for such things." It's that announcer. He's very gifted, very poised, charismatic even. Anybody who can sell glow-in-the-dark coat hangers to me could probably sell supply-side economics to America. Later that week, he met the announcer, a personable fellow named Bob Farhad. And Bob Farhad says, "These things you've told me are very disturbing, Mr. Oxbogle. I had no idea there was so much suffering in the tycoon sector." Mr. Oxbogle says, "Yes, it's awful, but you can help us." "Me? How?" "In Congress." "Really? But I have no political experience." "Nonsense. You're a natural, and I've got your positions all worked out." Well, that was the beginning. And Bob Farhad gradually took a liking to politics. And Gerard Oxbogle introduced him to an economist named Arthur Giggle, who had a theory of economics called the Giggle Wiggle, which he had proved scientifically with a terrarium full of earthworms and with cookie crumbs and earthworms. And after he was indoctrinated in supply side economics, he got elected to Congress and. And with help of these media experts, that's where the perceptual engineers and the charismaticians come in. And he was on his way. Now, have I filled you in?
Yeah. So he's a puppet of the tycoon sector.
Seems like it. There's something that I haven't totally explored yet, but there's an emotional thing between Bob Forehead and Gerard Oxbogle that he feels anyway enormous sympathy for the suffering in the tycoon sector.
Another thing that I'd like you to explain is the JFK lookalike conservative caucus and Bob Forehead's role in that.
Yeah, Bob Forehead is the leader of the JFK lookalike caucus, and that actually was inspired by what seems to be happening in our Congress, which I think there is something of a JFK lookalike caucus. And when I first went down to Washington. And I was poking around, and I didn't know a lot about politics and about what was going on down there. And I started noticing that. I remember very, very clearly, as many people do, the Kennedy assassination. And I remember a certain kind of when he was assassinated. There was this void, and there was this kind of nostalgia for his image. I mean, even separate from his politics, there was this nostalgia for Kennedy, and it lasted for a long time. And I started noticing when I was down there that a lot of people down there seemed to be playing off his image, and you know, this was suddenly TV politics, and it seemed like there were a lot of people that, regardless of what their politics were using this image. So I came up with this thing called the JFK Lookalike Conservative Caucus, and I have one part of here where Bob Forehead unites these guys, and he says, I know you all want to. He holds a meeting with all these people, and he says, "I know you all want to be president. So do I. But rather than compete with each other, why not work together for our mutual benefit? My charismatician tells me there is enough charisma in this room right now to propel a Learjet from Los Angeles to Buffalo. Working together, we could help each other and become president one at a time, making each other our vice presidents and appointing others of us to our cabinets, and dominate the executive branch into the next century and pass the torch to our children and their children and keep the world safe for supply side for centuries to come. It's a big job. It won't be easy, but let us begin."
What do you think it is that conservatives now have that Kennedy look?
Why is it that they do that?
Yeah.
I think it was just that Kennedy started this, the power of television. I actually think that what happened was some kind of subconscious ache in our country for that kind of charisma or that kind of image. And I think actually Reagan has filled that to some degree. He's sort of satisfied that longing to some degree for somebody who fills up the TV screen well and somebody who has poise and a certain kind of way of carrying himself. And we haven't had a president like that since Kennedy who has that kind of persona. And I think lots of congressmen have just picked up on that persona because it sells. And they even, I mean, some of them, you know, quote Kennedy outright and play off the image in such an obvious way that it just struck me as terrifically absurd. So
it strikes me that in your view of politics, that the success of political leaders really boils down to their charisma, good looks, poise, and ability to say the right thing at the right time, according to surveys and opinion polls.
I'd say that's a lot of it. It's funny. I should say I have some mixed feelings about it. For a comic strip, you pick the best targets to deal with. I run on two tracks about this. I think there's a lot of that, and I think really manipulating perceptions is what it's about to survive. And that's the art of politics. And a lot of people do it, I think, in a rather empty, cynical way. And at the same time, I've noticed from being around these people, the craft of politics and the fact that it's a job, it's a tough job, it's an art, sort of. It's a craft, and it's some people do it well with integrity, and some people do it lousily, and some people do it. I mean, people do it in many different ways, just like any kind of craft. But I'd say, in one way, I have a less respect for politicians, and in another way, I have this is going to sound ridiculous, but I have more respect for politicians. I have more respect for what their job is, and for those who do it well. I guess there was a time when I thought they were all phonies, you know, and now I realize that they're real people doing a difficult job.
My guest is Mark Allen Stamaty, who draws the Washington strip, which is featured in the Philadelphia Inquirer Monday mornings on the op-ed page, also carried in the Village Voice and the Washington Post. It originated in the Post. Would you tell us how you started to do the strip?
What happened was I'd been working for the Voice for about 3 years, and my McDoodle Street book came. My McDoodle Street comic strip came out as a book, and at that point, Meg Greenfield, the editor of the editorial and op-ed pages of the Washington Post, called me up. She had been she'd been reading my strip for several years. I don't know how long she'd been reading before, but she called me up suddenly. I didn't even know who she was. I got this message. I called her back. She said she wanted to use my strip on her page, or she wanted to do something with my work on her page. Now, I was at that time, the strip I was doing was completely off the wall. But she wanted to do something with my work. So I went down and I had a meeting with her, and she brought in a couple of other editors, and they were saying things like talking about cutting a deal or something. And then I went back to New York, went down for another meeting, at which point she brought in the other three top editors of the Post, including Ben Bradley, which completely blew my mind because I thought immediately of Jason Robards, and I thought I was in the middle of the movie, and you know, we're standing there three blocks from the White House, and I'm sitting there wondering, what am I doing in this room, you know, with these the four people that run the Post and the Washington Post, and I'm sitting there thinking things like, how does a person sit in a chair in front of Ben Bradley? And so they say to me, they would like me to do a McDoodle Street version of Washington. That's what they're interested in. And Meg, basically, it was basically Meg's baby. I mean, she pushed it, from the beginning and was selling people on it. So I told them I hardly know anything about it. I don't know anything about Washington. I've been there about three times in my life. I don't know that much about politics. I basically considered myself somewhat apolitical, not a terrifically political person. And so I said I had to research. And so what I started doing was going down to Washington back and forth from New York and just going everywhere, like just trying to figure out what was going on. Now, previously, the work I'd done in New York was about about New York and having my work for many years was teeming with New York. It was so I had spent a lot of time walking the streets of New York, watching it very closely, watching everything and absorbing it. So now I wanted to do the same thing with Washington. I wasn't going to just do it from the newspapers or something because I had to be there and feel it and just feel the atmosphere. The vibes, you know.
Uh-oh.
And oh my God. And but anyway, so. So then first thing I tried to do was figure out the machine, like what was connected to what. I mean, I wanted to find out what Congress was about. At the time, I didn't even know what exactly congressional hearings were. But people said, well, go to congressional hearings. That's where the meat of it is. So I went to tons and tons of congressional hearings. And I'd get up, you know, like from 9 in the morning till, you know, 5 in the evening. I'd sit through these hearings and to catch as many as I could in a day. And day after day. And then one time I went into Meg's office and I said, I want to get closer to things. I want to get closer to things than I am. I also knew there were lobbyists, et cetera, et cetera. And I was trying to figure out the lobbyists connected to Congress, connected to industry, connected to interest groups. But I went to Meg and I said, I want to get a little closer to things. Can you get me closer? And so she called in Howard Simons, the managing editor. He called in Peter Milius, the editor of the National Desk. And Howard said to Peter, we've got to plug Mark into a heart and lung machine. That's the way they talk in Washington, right? You see, it's funny the way they use words in Washington. I mean, in Congress and everywhere, they take these words and they basically mangle them, and they basically turn. You know, it's not about poetry down there. You know, it's about function. Words used for function. And there's a anyway. So, but that was part of this Washingtonese, which was really fascinating the way he said that. But And they the heart and lung machine was I went to the Hill a few times with one of the reporters covering milk price subsidies, and I asked him a lot of questions about it. And I saw it, you know, was just with him then, and the other that was Bob Kaiser, and then I went with Lee Lascaz, who was covering the White House at that point, and I went to the White House press room quite a few times and saw Reagan up close. We even went in the Oval Office a couple times for a very brief. With a pool of reporters, very brief times, and it was in sort of long ceremony things and stuff where Reagan was there, and where, you know, in the Rose Garden and these different parts around places around the White House, saw him hug the president of Venezuela, and saw him, you know, all these different things that they do around there, and so got a real feel of the White House press room and the reporters and the you know, how they handle the press and how they get dish it out to people. I mean, basically how they try to present the news to the press and how hard it is to get the news in any other form. And so I just started wandering around. Like I'd wander into hotels, and I started noticing in hotels in Washington they have these, well, kind of ridiculous things. It's every imaginable, every object in life probably has a trade association, a federation, a lobbyist in Washington, and every year they have a convention in Washington. You know, the toothpaste manufacturers association federation. A convention in Washington, and you go to the hotel and you see all these guys walking around with these badges, you know, men and women with, you know, that they're in this association, and just every week there's a new one. There's tons of these people, and it's funny. I mean, to see just so much of America pour through this place, Washington, and they all want to get there and influence. And one time I just wander around different places in Washington and see what was what and what was where. And one time I wandered into this room in the Capitol Hilton, I think it was, and I didn't know where I was, but it was some kind of they had hors d'oeuvres, and everybody was walking around eating these hors d'oeuvres, and I was acting like I belonged there. And at some point, a woman came to, and a lot of people had badges on. But at some point, a woman came up to me and said, "Who are you with?" And I said, "I don't know." And so she so she was real nice. She laughed and she said, "Oh, you can stay. That's all right." So I found out after a while, I found out that this was a this was some kind of a fundraising thing for, I think it was Senator Dodd, and it was like everybody had paid $500 to be there to eat hors d'oeuvres, and so I had gotten this little feel of how that worked, and then gradually I got to know different people on the Hill, and I got invited to different kinds of little things that go on there.
Why did what you see inspire you to create Bob Farhad as a leading character, someone who's like really bland, who's completely programmed by consultants, and who's very conservative?
It was a combination of a few things. There is a particular congressman who inspired this character. Although Bob Farhad is only this congressman when I want him to be. When I want him to be this congressman. I don't know if you know who it is, or do you have a clue? Or
no, I've met a couple of people who I thought,
right.
I thought might fit the bill, but can you tell us?
I'll confess the original inspiration for Bob Farhad, but who is not always Bob Farhad, and Bob Farhad is not always this congressman, but he can be when I want him to be, is Jack Kemp. He's a congressman from Buffalo, and you know, he had a very close association with Arthur Laffer, who writes economic theories on napkins, and who I've heard talk, who talks a mile a minute, and he had indoctrinated. I mean, as I understand it, he indoctrinated Kemp in his politics, and I mean in his economic theories. As far as I understood, or had a lot to do with it, with a few other people, I think Jude Wanniski or whoever else, so Arthur Giggle was inspired by Arthur Laffer, and that was Kemp would sometimes he was one of these people who would quote Kennedy, and there was he really seemed to really play up this thing, this image. Now I think the honest truth is, I think Jack Kemp is an intelligent, conscientious congressman. So I don't completely, that's why I can't completely, you know, lay all this on him. But I think the Bob Forehead thing has a lot to do with a feeling, a curiosity I have about what it's all about what these Congress. What the job is all about, what it does to people, what people's motives are for being in Congress. I think a lot of people don't quite know why they're there, I think congressmen, just like lots of people, are you know, they're in a career and they're trying to fulfill themselves in life, and a lot of times I think issues become secondary to whatever it is they're trying to figure out about life. I mean, wherever they're trying to get to, and being elected becomes more important than what they're promoting or what they're, you know, what policy is about. And policy becomes secondary. Policy decisions become secondary to maintain, you know, to keeping an office, because you get prestige, because that's what you do, because it's your life, whatever. And I think there's a certain point where people could completely lose themselves in that kind of a job, and I think some people do lose themselves in that kind of a job. And it's just the strain. I guess the momentum of political forces is, and the momentum of how the society runs is a lot of, you know, is the sort of things that that inspire that inspire Bob Forehead.
Do you find that the congressmen like Forehead, the Forehead types, turn on the charisma more when they're on TV or with the press than they do when they're just amongst their peers in pretty uneventful subcommittee hearings?
Generally they play the role whenever they're in their position. I mean, they posture whenever they're doing their thing. You know,
Mark Allen Stamaty is my guest. He does Washington, which is featured in the Enquirer on the op-ed page Mondays. It's also carried in the Village Voice and the Washington Post, and a collection of Washington strips has just been published by Congdon and Weed. And if you haven't seen it yet, Washington is a political comic satire in comic strip form. Can we go over some of the expressions that you've made up for the strip and tell us like what they're inspired from in real life? Maybe we could start with the Maryland Institute of Perceptronics.
Perceptronics, yeah, that was... Well, I started noticing this thing. I started noticing the importance of perception, and that perception is a word that's used a lot in Washington and in politics, and the idea that perception and what's the other word? A sense, like a sense of something, like these, a sense and a perception become. These things of enormous importance. I mean, they get people elected. They get, you know, when they have a policy and they put it out there to people, or they put a few words together and they try to sell it, like the peacekeeper missile or supply side economics or the New Deal, any of these things. You know, they put it out there and they see, will it fly? And will it fly is, it has to do with, you know, will it fly in many people's minds? Will it fill up like an invisible helium balloon and create this perception in people? And will it have this percept? You know, then the idea that what happened was when I was down there sitting in these hearings, you sit in these hearings and you hear these people talking. It's saying all of these words and wrestling over these bills over the language. In a bill, the language in legislation. And one time I was sitting there and I was just noticing, I started to notice this more and more, just feel this more and more there's all this activity going on, all this intensity, all these experts, all these elected officials, and they're all wrestling over these words. And what they're creating is something that's basically invisible. It doesn't, you can't touch it. It's invisible. It's something that all of our minds and emotions agree exists. I mean, like a law is that's what it is. And a perception is that's what it is. And that the whole thing, politics and power and all this stuff had so much to do with the invisible. And so perception, I have this man who is the perceiver general of the United States, and he's the most important person in the administration because he's basically charged with that responsibility of creating and keeping alive perceptions. I also had I had something about fuzz words. I came up with a term called fuzz words, and they were fuzz words speak to this is where I can read about this. Bob's perceptual engineer is talking to one of his staffers, and he said he's saying that lately, I've detected an emerging perception of Bob as being purely image and lacking in substance. We've got to counter this purely image with an image of Bob as having an in-depth grasp of issues. Fuzzwords can do this. The vast majority of Americans are very upset about our economy. They are also very fuzzy-minded about what should be done or even what exactly is causing the problems. Whenever they try to figure it out, they become engulfed in a vast mental fuzziness. Fuzzwords speak to this fuzziness and offer hope. Fuzzwords express concepts that elude the comprehension of the average voter. Bob, for instance, might urge a non-interventionist monetary policy or call for the Federal Reserve to abandon its targets of aggregates. If spoken with an air of confident authority, fuzzwords like these could attract millions of anxious, fuzzy-minded voters who have lost faith in politicians who use only buzzwords. The aide was impressed. So that's fuzzwords. Okay, so fuzzwords, that was one of the really that was in the first year of doing the strip. It's been going for 2 years now, and that was one of the times I really like pushed a Washington button, and that was a lot of fun because the 2 weeks that I did fuzzwords. A cousin of mine happened to be who's in the direct mail business happened to be in Washington. He told me he saw a congressman giving a speech somewhere, and the day that my first one of those strips came out, and he said, "Well, the congressman said what we need is more fuzzwords." And then I saw Trent Lott on Meet the Press that following Sunday, and Trent Lott used the term fuzzwords in the midst of the interview, and the Wall Street Journal that week used this they used the word fuzz phrases in the Washington column, and then Barry Goldwater wrote a letter to the Washington Post a couple weeks later, and he used the term fuzzwords, and it was like it's like if you hit a button in Washington, it just spreads all over, and that's a lot of fun.
That's like another term that you've created, and that's charismaticians. What are they based on?
Charismaticians is that's based essentially on this whole notion of charisma as a marketable commodity, and basically, I suppose, I mean, in me, that goes back before perceptions and everything of just, I mean, that goes back in me of the first time I ever saw the Brooklyn Dodgers, and I was a Brooklyn Dodger fan. I always saw them on television. One time, my father brought me to the game, and I actually saw these ball players in person. Duke Snider, Gil Hodges, Charlie Neal, these were all my heroes. And I saw these guys in person. And seeing somebody that you've seen on TV, you know, seeing a famous person, like the power, the impact of seeing the person, it's amazing. I mean, it was amazing to me, the impact of it. I mean, we all have had that experience, I think, when you see somebody very famous like that. Me as a kid, you know, the first time seeing that, it was such an amazing thing. So I guess it's like I've always been fascinated by that, by the power of charisma and why it has such a sort of jolting effect and how it works and what it is. So that's, it's strange that it's, once again, it's this sort of invisible thing that has such an impact.
And charismaticians help you get it?
Oh, charismaticians. Yeah. I have something in here about the, let's see if I can find it. The charismatician, Leonard Bullion, Leonard Bullion, Bob's charismatician, a master of the science of charismatics, he is charged here with the duty of raising Bob's charisma level. Today we work on your eyes. There are 40,000 votes in your eyes alone, if you learn to use them right. Another advisor is Tom Mimmelman, a foremost authority on shirt sleeves. For the TV spot, I recommend a sleeve roll-up of 2BE. That's 2 inches below the elbow. My surveys indicate that men with sleeves at this level are perceived as serious and hardworking, while retaining a sense of style that is lost above the elbow.
Have you talked with any of the media consultants?
Actually, no. I heard one of them said something about my comic strip being, the truth or something about there's the man down there who really believes that he makes and breaks these people, and I heard that he believed that I was telling the bald truth about it. I know somebody who does the sound for some of those commercials, and I had an opportunity to go along and see some of them made, and I didn't have time to do that, but I did talk with them. I've met a lot of different people around Washington. I mean, I'm always sort of poking around trying to get in little nooks and crannies and see how it works, and so I had a little exposure to that.
Yeah, the election period, and we're on election day now, must be a very fruitful time for you for research, since you get to see so many of those terrific political ads on TV. Do you make a point of watching for them this time of year?
I try to if I can catch them. I haven't seen a lot lately because I guess being in New York, there's not a lot happening right now. There's some kind of bond issue, but so we don't have a mayoral election. We don't have it quite as. But I did last year the 82 election. I caught quite a lot of that, and I'm fascinated by it. I think it's just this. Well, I mean. The things I'd say about it, probably every person out there would say something similar about just how strange it is to have the television have this kind of power and what it means. I mean, to suddenly, people that are getting elected now probably would not have gotten elected years ago. Even Ronald Reagan, I don't know, without television, I doubt he would have ever been president. It's it's really changing the whole face of our government.
I remember when a lot of politicians used to be funny looking, and very, very few of them, except for the older ones. The younger ones don't seem to be now. Many of them look like Bob Farhad.
lots of them. I mean, yeah, there's this look thing and this way. You know, a lot of times another thing that Bob Farhad sort of touches in me is, and a lot of these politicians do, is I just remember Catcher in the Rye, Holden Caulfield, he had this roommate Stradlater. I don't know if you remember. It was just in the very beginning of Catcher in the Rye, and he used to talk about his roommate Stradlater, who just sort of had this way of. He was like a super cool person, but he had this way of carrying himself, and there was some dwelling on Stradlater's image. But sometimes these people remind me of Stradlater.
Do congressmen ever ask for copies of your originals?
Yeah, they do from time. Well, there are copies. I mean, I haven't actually. Yeah, they do ask for copies. Yeah, copies. A few have, and I've heard that I have a lot of fans on Capitol Hill, and I've met a number of congressmen who are fond of the strip and enjoy it,
I was interviewing Jules Pfeiffer about a year ago, and he said that Johnson's aides had once asked for a copy of a really unflattering cartoon about Johnson, and I asked him why he thought that Johnson would want an unflattering cartoon. He said, these guys love it because it makes it seem like, it's all a game. I mean, they don't like me, but ha ha ha, it doesn't matter, it's all a game. And cartoons reinforce that feeling. Have you gotten that feeling?
That's interesting. I heard from basically two people that I actually did things about, and they weren't the most well-known people, but I heard from some people from William Baxter's office, he's in the Department of Justice. I did something about merger therapy, and it was basically about him, encouraging mergers he apparently liked the cartoon, and they asked for a copy of it, so I sent them a copy. Somebody in Richard Viguerie's office or associated with him wanted a copy of something when I did something about Richard Viguerie. I was surprised about that. I don't know if that was Richard Viguerie himself wanting it or not, but I think it's, somebody said, you know, like Herblock, I see him quite a lot when I'm at the Post, and his secretary, I think, said something about how they, these people are flattered by, I mean, to them, it's kind of being celebrity. I mean, it's, they, you know, and I also think it, I could relate to it. If I were in a position like that, I suppose it's, to a degree, it would be fun to see yourself made into a cartoon. I guess it depends on, it'd be an experience.
Mark Allen Stamaty is my guest, who draws and writes the strip Washington, which is now featured in the Philadelphia Inquirer on Mondays. Do you know the story behind the Inquirer picking it up?
I don't know it in detail, except, let's see, how did it, I don't know. I've known Tony Auth for about 2 years, and I was told that a couple of people there were reading, I guess maybe Ed Guthman and Tony were reading the strip for quite a while and liked it, and I don't know, I'm not sure exactly the whole, you know, that's what I heard. I guess a few people there were following it and wanted to pick it up. So I just, every now and then I hear from a paper and I make a deal with them.
It must be a different world for you to be traveling in the world of political cartoonists, because he used to be doing McDoodle Street, which was impressions of eccentric people and overheard conversation and things like that in the village. And that's just a completely different tradition than the one you're part of now.
Yeah, it's funny, for a lot of my life, I didn't particularly want to be a political cartoonist, because I thought it would, basically, I didn't think I knew anything about, or I didn't think I knew very much about politics, and I didn't think I particularly wanted to put myself out in public about it. And then suddenly this thing came up, and here I had this chance to learn about it. I had this chance to go there and absorb this place and learn all these things that I didn't know. And I thought that if I did political cartoons, my view of political cartooning was that you get labeled. It's like I political people that I knew were always very absolute about things, and there was no room for gray areas generally. And it was sort of like you think along a certain line, and therefore these are all the positions you have to have, and if you don't have those positions, you know, they don't even hear you. I mean, nobody, you know, no, there's nothing about conversation. It's like you are a, you know, something. I mean, they start calling you names, basically. And so I never particularly wanted to be in all these arguments that with people. I mean, because I went to art school. I was used to the idea of thinking what I wanted to think. And I felt like politics worked in this kind of team mentality that you take the position of the team, and you don't think, basically. You just accept the herd mentality. That was my impression of it. When I suddenly found myself, you know, I found this thing put in front of me, with some hesitation, I realized it was just too good to not do. And so I thought that I would, you know, I was afraid I'd be in the middle of all these, find myself in the middle of all these arguments with people about, you know, who wanted to call me this and wanted to call me that from all sides. And the arguments that I didn't particularly care to be in the midst of. But as it turned out, I found that I could actually express myself in terms of politics. First place, I could actually learn it. I mean, I realize now, having gone to Washington for almost 3 years, I still think of myself as just having got there and being something of a novice. However, I've met a lot of politicians and journalists who basically think I know what I'm talking about. And as a matter of fact, it's strange. See, what happened was, in the beginning, I'd have these conversations with people. I should just kind of go through this a little bit. I'd have these conversations. I was invited to this party. And when I first went down there, and I'm talking to Haynes Johnson, who's this journalist for the Washington Post, and I make some remark about I didn't know what to say to him. I mean, I had no idea on earth what to say to this person, and I'm standing there in this conversation with him, and I said something about how I didn't it, some I said some inane stupid remark and about, you know, ignorant sort of remark, and felt very embarrassed, and he corrected me, and I felt like a fool. And but it was about a year later that that I ran into him at the same party a year later, and he liked the strip, and he was very encouraging about it. Thought I was doing a good job. What happened was I noticed that gradually in my as I educated myself in my conversations with people, I'd slowly find that I knew what I was talking about, and that we were having, you know, that we were on some kind of equal level. Another thing I learned about Washington was I was going to say I'm going down there 3 years and still feeling like I'm new there. Somebody called me from Washington to interview me for a magazine and about a few weeks ago, and we're talking, and it turns out that he has been in Washington a year. I've been going down there 3 years, and he thinks of me as a veteran. And I'm thinking of him as, you know, I was thinking of him as the Washington person. And I realized that there's such a turnover down there anyway that, you know, you hang around there for 3 years and you're an old man. You've been, you know, you've been there and back.
Well, today's election day. What customarily happens to Bob Farhead around election day, particularly if he's running for office?
What does happen? I don't know if I have an answer for that question. Let's see. You know, I think I should just I off the top of my head I couldn't tell you. I just don't have an answer for it.
Okay.
Is that all right?
You're gonna fail on this one.
Oh God, what's my score?
What's the next question?
Right.
I know what I wanted to do. I wanted to ask you to either read or summarize for us what you had Farhead doing right after Grenada.
Grenada. Oh yeah, he actually.
The strip's been getting pretty topical,
well,
I think.
Yeah, this was. Oh, I can. Well, I can read this one for you. And I actually did something about Grenada that's going to be in next week. He just. But well, yeah, wait till, there's a little mention of it next week. Okay, this begins with an American. This was the one from Monday. This begins with an American, typical American watching TV. A little more bounce in his step. A little more self-assurance. And the TV is saying, U.S. Marines have taken Grenada. And the guy says, I just feel better. It's an overall feeling, a sense of well-being. He wasn't the only one. Lots of Americans were feeling it. We've finally asserted ourselves. Now the world knows we can't be pushed around. Gosh, if a small-scale invasion feels this good, imagine how great a war would feel. Meanwhile, exhaustive opinion polls were being taken. If U.S. Marines invaded Nicaragua and the ensuing conflict were made into a TV miniseries, would you watch it? Yes, said 62%. Meanwhile, in Congressman Bob Forehead's office, his staff was feeding results of these polls into their new computer. When they waited for Bob's newest positions to be printed out, then they waited for Bob's newest positions to be printed out. How do I feel about Lebanon? Asked Bob. The computer responded with a stream of dark smoke. It seems to be breaking down. For a brief moment, Bob was afraid. How could he face the press? Then he remembered the words of his charismatician. When the going gets tough, the tough learn to fake it. Bob held a press conference that day and handled it so well that nobody had any idea where he stood on anything.
Oh, that was very funny. I don't know if you found this to be true, but sometimes I think that one of the greatest tools for politicians who don't want to be pinned down to anything when they're speaking with an interviewer or with a reporter is to either be really fuzzy or to be very long-winded and boring because it gets hard to follow, you know? And even I think a journalist will find their attention wandering if someone is really like long-winded and dull.
I think it's talk about anything authoritatively. I think you'll see that over and over with politicians is whatever the direct question is, if they respond directly and authoritatively and sound like they know what they're talking about, people, I think what happens is the viewer sits there in disbelief. I mean, they think now, they asked him a question about, you know, about the situation in Lebanon, and he's now talking about, you know, Nicaragua. How did that happen? And then you And then I think what happens is the mind flips off, and they say he couldn't possibly sit in public and do that. You know, I mean, he can't. How could he do that? It can't possibly be happening. And then it's like, I think it's like instant amnesia. And then you just listen to what the guy's saying. You just go, you know, you just take it from there. I think there's this, you know, this like sort of instant disbelief.
Do you categorize yourself politically as a moderate or liberal, radical, conservative?
I'll tell you the term I prefer, the term I like, because I in some way I resent all of those terms. I prefer the term I like to think in terms of the word humane. I hope that, you know, that's what I'd like it to be about, and that's what I'd like it to be about. I'd rather say it that way than any other way.
Something I've been wanting to know about your handwriting in the drawing of the strips. You sometimes print, and sometimes a word will suddenly be in script, and some of the words are capitalized. And as the whole, it gives a very eccentric feel to it in the handwriting that you use for the balloons of speech coming out of people's mouths and for the captions. That's intentional, I'm sure.
Yeah, different people have different reactions to how I draw. I mean, how I do this, but I say, for instance, I mean, I can draw realistically, whatever, but there's certain kinds of so-called naive art that I like, that has an appeal to me. And I went to an art school. I went to Cooper Union in New York City, and I looked at lots of art and drew a lot. And we had 2 years of calligraphy, kind of intense calligraphy courses. So I learned a lot of that. And I'd say that there's just a kind of visual play that I like to be involved in. There's a feel that I like about playing with the letters like that, and it's purely sort of it's an intuitive thing. It's just purely to please myself.
Your father was a cartoonist, wasn't he?
Yeah, both of my parents were cartoonists, my mother and father. And my mother, in fact, was almost syndicated twice. But she did a single panel cartoons called Sitter Sue, about a lot of cartoons about teenagers. They were in a lot of Ladies Home Journal, Saturday Evening Post, etc. A lot of magazines and teenage magazines. My father, Stanley Stamity. My mother was Clara G. Kastner. My father, Stanley Stamity, was in all the major markets in those days, or most of the major markets in those days. Did single panel cartoons in the Saturday Evening Post, Look, Collier's, when that was a magazine, lots and lots of magazines. And basically I grew up in the midst of that life. My father would, which really scared me to death. It scared me to death that to have our sustenance come out of this hairy situation of these little pieces of 8.5 by 11 rag paper. When you do this little cartoon on it called A Rough, and you mail these things out, or you take them in once a week to New York. I'd go into New York sometimes with my father on Wednesdays, and they'd go around with all the cartoonists and watch them go to the editors, and they'd go into the cartoon editor, leave the 12 roughs, the guy'd look through them, he'd hold some, and then there would be this wait to see if he'd give an okay. They'd write in little pencil, okay in the corner, and that was the big deal. That was victory. And an okay from the Saturday Evening Post in those days paid $75, and it was the biggest deal happening. And my parents sometimes would even they'd iron these roughs on an ironing board. You know, when they'd send them out for a while and they'd get a little wrinkled, and they'd iron these pieces of paper and send them out. Anyway, I grew up amidst all of that.
That makes you probably one of the few children in America who had parents who didn't mind it if you read comics.
That's probably true. Yeah, that's probably true.
Did you read a lot of them?
I read a lot of comics. I do regret that that's for some reason all my life I've been a very slow reader, which is still a problem trying to read all this stuff about politics. But I had a lot of comics. But my mother, regardless of what you just said, my mother did what so many mothers do. She at some point she threw out my comics. I don't you know how you have this huge. Some point she did that.
How insensitive for a cartoonist to do that.
Well, yeah, I don't know. She was also a mother, and mothers do those things.
Well, today's election day. Do you take voting more or less seriously since you've been doing Washington?
More seriously, and the whole thing I take much more seriously. What I was saying about having a growing respect for politicians and the political process. While a lot of people read my stuff and they think it's cynical or whatever, I try to go at the things that I think deserve to be gone at. At the same time, I have to say this thing there I was sitting in New York, And the editors of the Washington Post called me up. The editor of the editorial page of the Washington Post called me up and invited me to make fun of the president and to make fun of the government. That is amazing. The other thing is, I didn't even ask them to do it. There are people getting, in prison for that stuff all over the world, and they asked me to do it. And the other thing is that I, regardless of what people will say about our system or whatever, the structure of our government, I find it really fascinating to see how it's all put together. I like looking at politics on a local level and all the way up and in a way that I never did before, and looking at this government that we basically created. I go in Congress and into the Capitol building and all the congressional hearings and all this stuff, and it reminds me of like when I was a kid, four kids in a clubhouse. Like four kids, when we were kids, we were always trying to form a clubhouse and make this structure and make it work, and we never quite could get it together. But suddenly you see that these things that I thought were these permanent, carved in stone kind of institutions, I suddenly realized that how human the thing is, how human the government is, and how it's something created by people, and people continually, we do govern ourselves. I do believe we do. I mean, money does play a heavy role in it, and there is, it is unfortunate a lot of what goes on about lack of representation. But the way it works and how human it is fascinating to me. And yes, voting means more to me than it used to.
That's really interesting. Mark, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us today. I really enjoy your strip. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. I had a great time.
Mark Allen Stamaty has been my guest, and he draws and writes the Washington strip, which is a satire of Washington politics. It started off commissioned for the Washington Post. It's featured in the Village Voice, where he previously did McDoodle Street. And for the last couple of months, it's been appearing Mondays on the op-ed page of the Philadelphia Inquirer. A collection of Washingtons has just been published in book form by Congdon and Weed, and if you're new to Washington, you'll get to find out the history of Bob Farhad and the story of his entrance into electoral politics by reading this book. It's called Washington by Mark Allen Stamaty, again published by Congdon and Weed.